I think so.
I opened the House Committee on Land Use. Today's February 19th at 3 p.m. And I'm going to open, I'll open a public hearing, though I don't think we have anybody signed up, on House Bill 2441. And this bill, you remember, we have no one signed up, right?
Correct, at this point.
Yeah. Colleagues, this was a bill Representative Johnson brought having to do with properties and buildings on forest land versus ag land. There was some discussion about whether the bill was written correctly to actually get the land use part dealt with and not just the building part dealt with. We have amendments that the proponents and the agency have reviewed to make sure it would cover what the proponents wanted it to cover, and it now does appear to be drafted in such a way that would cover it. And I have two members signed up to testify. Roger is not needed. Jim, not needed.
Not unless you want something for the record.
We'll make it easier, probably, if no one talks. So no public hearing. I'm going to close the public hearing then on 2441, open a work session on House Bill 2441. My one vice chair isn't here. Is my other vice chair willing to move some amendments?
I can do that.
The dash two. What are they called? Dash one
amendments. And there's your script.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2441 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, first, I need to adopt the amendments.
I move to adopt the dash two amendments.
Dash one.
Dash one amendments to House Bill 2141.
Representative Frederick moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2441. I'll just say that these amendments are designed to both clearly authorize in the land use portion of the statutes that the building can be used on forest lands. It also has a little bit of protective language to make sure that these are uses that are typically used in this type of forest-related activity and not designed to be, you know, you can have a building you can use for anything just in a forest zone. They're for things to be in conjunction with forest-related activities. And the language says, customarily provided in conjunction with farm or forest use as a kind of a sideboard.
In the dash ones?
In the dash ones.
Dash ones, yeah.
And so that's the these particular amendments, that's kind of the point. Get them into land use statutes, put the sideboards on that the buildings wouldn't be used for non-farm or forest-related things. Any more discussion on the dash one amendments? Any objection to the dash one amendments? So adopted.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that I move that House Bill 2441, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2441 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Unger.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Clement.
Aye. Motion passes. Bill goes to the floor, and we'll ask Representative Johnson to carry it. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2028. This is my bill, but I won't waste time going up to whatever that's called, dais, podium, something. So let me just tell you a little bit of the history of this. The bill, as it's written, I think is probably a little bit broader than I need it to be, at least for what I'm about to describe. And you'll hear, I think, some testimony to that effect. I think we can work out some language with folks from the cities that targets what at least I'm trying to get at. Not sure that means they'll support it, but at least we could agree that the language is targeted at the right thing. So this bill and the topic and the witness for it in particular was heard last session in Representative Holby's committee. And here's the specific circumstance that brought it to my attention. People who live in Marion County but not in a city in some cases, when trying to get services from the county, have been directed down to the city because the county doesn't offer those services. The one I'm particularly worried about are things that are temporary in nature, like I need to remodel my kitchen and I want to get a building permit. And they're not on city water, they're not on city sewer, they're not asking for any kind of permanent city anything. They just wanted to go to the county and get their building permit. And they were able to get it, but first they had to sign an agreement saying, I will voluntarily consent to annexation when that time comes that the city is near my property. And we consider that, in my view, it's a hostage situation. You don't get your building permit if you don't sign the agreement. And in some cases, they would be appropriate to have people sign non-remonstrance agreements, I think. This is not one of those cases, because this is only a contracted service by a county who is normally the provider of all their services, sheriff, patrol, that kind of thing. But in this particular case, they needed to go down to the city because the county just didn't do it, and for government efficiency's sake, they had it contracted to the city. The particular person who came in to testify when we heard the bill last session was a gentleman who owns a business outside the city, on well, on septic, not on city infrastructure, and needed to put up a building. It's in Representative Cameron's district. Needed to put up a building, steelhead, metal, and fab, over behind Oregon Pallet off of Kubler and Turner Road. And they needed to put up a building so they could expand and hire more people. And he was sent down to the city because, again, the county doesn't issue permits. It was for a warehouse type of building. They don't issue permits. So they sent down to the city. The city made him sign a non-remonstrance agreement, even though he didn't want to. Then when the city limits touched the property, that they had a non-consent, or they had a non-remonstrance agreement, or they had a consent form basically on file from that incident, and then they put him forward for annexation. They charged him the cost of the election to annex him that he didn't want to be annexed, and the cost of the postage or the ballot or something. He had to pay a fee and several thousand dollars for a study related to annexation because he was in the urban service area. And I just felt that he should not have to, at that moment, go in and suffer that particular hostage situation just to get the building permit. If he was trying to hook onto city water or sewer, I think that's a whole different equation. That's not what I'm trying to get at when I'm talking about these bills. So that's how the bill got here, and that's why I introduced it. You can, I guess, ask me questions now or wait till you hear from other people, and then we can debate it if we want to someday if we ever have a work session on this. But we've got...
Do we have witnesses today?
We do. We've got four folks to testify.
Mr. Chair, are you proposing... Thank you. Are you proposing amendments to this bill?
I believe after we're done with the testimony, there will need to be amendments to this bill in order to address some of the concerns that people will raise. Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, since you're not down there, we'll ask
right.
you up here.
Yeah.
You made a comment that
I want to keep my gavel so you can't overrule me.
The county doesn't issue permits.
Building permits in these circumstances that I've described, when the person contacted the county, they said, we don't issue those here. We have the city of Salem do that for us on contract.
I'm just trying to think of, it'd be interesting to have testimony about that, because I know I'm going to use the city of Detroit, for example. It's the exact opposite. The city of Detroit doesn't issue the permit. The county does. So why wouldn't the county be issuing a permit for a building of somebody who's residing in the county?
In this case, if I remember right, it was because he's in the urban growth boundary but not in the city of Salem, they have a review process that's done on any permit request for people who fit that particular situation. And it was the review and compliance with maybe like the, you know, urban services plan or something like that that led him to go down to the county. I've had people who live, one lady, I remember going door to door and talking to her, and she said that she had to go down just to get this back building remodeled on her property right along Center or State Street, just outside the city limits. Close though, and probably same deal. Within the urban growth boundary, not outside the urban growth boundary, but not in the city either, for a remodel on a outbuilding, basically, on her shop, on her place.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll get into our witnesses, and then if you want to grill me, I can even go over there if it's really fun to do. Let's have Jerry Ritter come up, and Jessica, do you want to come up? And I'll just do two and two. We've got two other folks, and we'll just get two and two. Jerry, you're first. Go ahead, please, on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Jerry Ritter, representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. Mr. Chairman, you made my job easy because you said everything I was going to say for the most part. I can tell you that this is going on all around the state. And as you pointed out, it's a situation where people are being required to sign consent to annexation agreements for the simple act of getting a building permit. In Lane County, the way this works is that the county has delegated to the cities the task of issuing building permits under an IGA. And so when the city issues the permit, they demand consent to annexations. You've covered the reasons why we support this bill, and I thank you for introducing this. We see no legitimate reasons for these demands. There's no statutory requirement that we know of. There is an interpretation of 222.115 where cities say we're allowed to do it. That may be true, but it's not demanded. In addition, I have included in our testimony a section from a 2006 Legislative Council opinion on the matter. And I'll quote what they said, quote, a city may require consent to annexation only for delivering its own services, not for acting as an agent of the appropriate service provider. I provided your administrator with a copy of the entire opinion for your review if you want. What you have is a highlighted version. Mr. Chair, as you pointed out, this bill addresses, at least partially, what we call hostage annexations. It does not revoke the right of a city to require annexation for delivery of an actual city service where it has not been delivered before, for example, as you pointed out, sewer and water. Nor are we asking you to do that. Now, some of you have supported us in the past in our efforts to bring fairness to Oregon's annexation statutes, and we appreciate that. And we'll ask you to continue that process with House Bill 2028 because the job is not over. And I'll also note that in Lane County, where this practice is going on, the County Commission is in favor of this bill. And that concludes my testimony. As always, thank you for listening and appreciate the opportunity. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for Jerry, or do we want to hear from the next witness first and then do them both?
I have one question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Jerry, your group is supporting House Bill 2028 as written?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Jerry? And we'll have you stay just in case something pops up while we're listening to Jessica. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the City of Salem, here to want to get to a yes on this bill. As it's currently written, we believe that the provisions of this bill unintentionally expand into city-provided services such as water, sewer, and stormwater services, and we're concerned about the broadness of the language. However, we do agree with the chair's / sponsor's intent in this legislation to not include services like, or temporary contracted services, things like building permits or septic services. The incident that chair discussed was related to a septic permit for this constituent of Representative Cameron, and we have, after receiving advice from our council, the city no longer asks folks coming in to get a permit to sign a non-remonstrance agreement. Those are only signed in cases where we are extending for the first time water, sewer, stormwater, those kinds of services. We're very happy to work with the chair and others to get to a place where we can be comfortable with this bill, and look forward to doing so.
Great. Any questions for either? Representative Davis.
Thank you both for your testimony. just drilling down into the language of the bill, because it sounds like everybody wants to tighten it up, I presume the efforts will surround the word service, where now there's no limiting language to that. Is that, Jessica, is that where you think that the meat of this would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that is correct. We believe that tightening down that definition gets at what the sponsor of the bill is looking for, and I think provides better clarity to us and doesn't lead to unintended consequences in the future.
Right. It seems to me, follow up, seems to me service can be extremely broadly defined, and I don't see a ORS definition anywhere for it in the statute, so I'd like to see that, and thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Okay. Any other questions for either of these two nice people? Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you, Jerry, for your testimony. Would you be supportive of the bill still in that amended form?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we need to see the language. We felt that the bill was fairly narrowly defined on service, defining service as a service that a city provides under contract, i.e. as a surrogate for a county, not an actual city service. For example, if the Springfield Utility Board were to extend water service extraterritorially, that's clearly a city service. They're not doing it for the county, and they could demand annexation in exchange for that under 222.115. If, however, that they are doing something like a building permit where they are actually providing a county service as a surrogate, then this bill would cover that, and we don't see that they should be allowed to require annexation in exchange for that.
And I won't get into all the legal beagling here, but you actually, if you look at the first part of the bill in Section 1, it's saying when a district or a city may do it, and then it comes down in Section 4 and says, and these are the places that's not allowed, and he's referring to does not include a service performed outside of the boundaries of a city on behalf of another local government. So that's where, you know, between we can talk about it and get LC in the room and hash that part out, or if there's some other sideboards that are the same, you know, basic-ish. But it's kind of written strangely. Clearly, it authorizes and then takes back away the part that I was interested in. Any other questions for these two at the moment? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Aaron Doyle and Mark Landauer, our other two. I think you've also got a little memo, too. Aaron's written testimony, maybe, or at least I do. It's coming, if not.
Probably is.
Oh, and Olis.
Yeah.
Mark, you're probably just going to freewheel and no written, no nothing, just charm us.
I wrote some notes.
Oh, okay, that's nice. On your hand.
Are they in Olis?
Yeah, his handprint is.
League of Oregon City.
Yeah, League of Oregon Cities is. Please, Aaron, you're first.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I have provided a written copy of my testimony, so I will not read that to you. But I would like to address a couple of things that haven't been addressed so far. First, in addition to the issue of how broadly or narrowly tailored extraterritorial services is, we are also significantly concerned with Sections 3 and Section 6 of the bill, which retroactively void these contracts to, or some contracts to annexation, which may have actually already been executed, and these folks might have been annexed into the city. We don't believe that these would be constitutional under the federal or Oregon constitutions related to contracts clauses, and we think that that's a big concern, and we also don't know how much it would cost to unravel all of that mess for us. In addition, again, like the other witnesses have spoken up about extraterritorial services, is broad in our opinion, because we do contracts with government agencies other than counties, and sometimes it does include providing some services that are traditionally urban services, either directly to the district or an area. So we want to help clarify that that's not what was intended with this legislation, because when we urbanize, we do it with a land use intention of keeping urban areas tight and in control of local government.
And that
okay. Sorry.
Any questions for Aaron? Representative Holding.
So I appreciate you pointing out Section 3. I was saving that one for much later, so I could unravel Chair Clem's agenda on this. But having pointed that out, I'm curious whether you see any other pieces of this bill that essentially prevent cities from annexing land inside the urban growth boundaries.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, we are concerned that it would hamper annexing if they are areas within the urban growth boundaries, and one way to annex urban areas is to use the connection of urban services. Once you do hook into water, when you hook into our roads and things of that nature, because urban services are, of course, more than just water and sewer. They also include transit. They include fire. They include public safety and things of that matter, or of that nature. We use that as an opportunity because you really are becoming a user of city services, and if you are a user of city services, then you should probably not only be part of the constituency that pays for it, but also have representation for your local government. You can do that through annexation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So, does anything in this bill compel a city to provide services to someone who is not annexed into the city?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, no, nothing compels us to provide the services. The services that I believe are intended to be directed at is we provide the service pursuant to an agreement with either a county or a district, and that would compel us to provide the service because we've agreed to do so. That might be another way in which we can more clearly define what extraterritorial services and which agreements in particular are at issue, I believe.
First one. Second one.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. So if the bill is clarified to say water and sewer or utilities types services that are obviously from the city, you'd be in favor of the bill?
We'd also still remain concerned about the retroactive voiding of the contracts to annex in the past, simply because we think that's unconstitutional. Of course, we would have to see the language, and we would work to get to the point where we could support it.
Thank you.
Chair Clinton.
Representative Davis.
Maybe you could go up about 10,000 feet for us and just talk about when a city has either agreed or, let's say, it hasn't agreed to provide a service like water or sewer, something that does have substantial infrastructure costs, and it agrees to do so. Regardless of whether or not the landowner signs an agreement like this, what sort of costs are borne by that landowner at the time of delivery of that service? Obviously, if they're not annexed in, they're not going to be paying city taxes.
Right.
But what sort of service fees do they pay initially for that service?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, I'm not sure. I think it is a case by case, but oftentimes there'll be some form of payment regarding the actual construction of the hookups or things of that nature, but it depends. It varies from city to city. In addition, if you're receiving water, if it's you might be able to pay water fees directly, but other types of infrastructure that aren't paid for on a
right.
fee basis. The other instance is how often these are. There are a huge number of cities that are doing this,
mm-hmm.
but when they are, they determine if it's working with a district, they'll determine how to split the costs when they sign those agreements. And that's what this is directed at. When it's an individual landowner, that's a ball of wax, you might say. Does that?
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example, in East Salem, people pay a surcharge. If they're not annexed, not in the city, they'll pay extra each water bill. And then if in some cases they'll end up paying the cost all the way from the main into their house, it might be $10,000 or $15,000 sometimes to pay
right.
that full connection to get
mm-hmm.
out to where the main is, and then monthly they'll pay more.
Well, and then I guess my question, Chair, is if they're paying both upfront for the cost of installation and they're paying a surcharge presumably for ongoing maintenance, then what's the rationale behind the city still wanting the ability to require consent?
And that is a whole different but
yeah,
big philosophical
yeah.
and part of it is contract law just two parties and one wants to put in a contract something, do they have the right to insist on whatever it is they want?
Right.
And, you know, it's a open philosophical question on that larger thing that I'm not trying to deal with in this bill, but it always gets dragged into this bill. And it dies every time. Representative Holby.
Thank you. Along those same lines.
In your committee. Sorry. So,
given that we have a resident that's inside an urban growth boundary, that's in an unincorporated area, that is paying for services that they've acquired, be it water or whatever. The idea about cities providing services is that the whole tax base pays equally for that. How does the city charge those individuals that are in that unincorporated area for the times that they're driving on the urban streets and using other urban services?
Chair Clem, Representative Lee, they can't. That is a service that is subsidized by the folks who live within the city limits, paying the city property taxes to maintain those roads. Obviously, they pay for it, but the unincorporated folks may not pay for it unless there's county contributions, things of that nature. Within the UGB in particular, I believe it's the same that as if they were just not incorporated into the city.
So I guess my follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be if you have one of these agreements where a person in an unincorporated area is paying for a specific service, how would you prevent them from using the other services like parks that are in the city and, you know, other sorts of protections that are within the city? I mean, how do you equitably charge them for those, or do you?
Representative Holy, Chair McClellan, excuse me. We can't. We don't have the taxing authority to go out and get to folks who are not within our taxing districts. We would have to modify our taxing structures completely in order to collect taxes for services traditionally provided under property taxes.
Mr. Chair? So these people that are living in this urban growth area then are able to utilize the other services and not pay for them like other citizens inside the annexed areas?
Representative Clem, Representative Holy, yes, they are able to use the services without paying for them. However, being in urban growth boundaries is part of the 20-year plan of getting you into urban levels of living, basically, and eventually bring you into a city through annexation and using the laws that are on the books as is, because if you're in that UGB, the intention is to have urban levels of services out there eventually within that 20 years. That is the way we define our UGB as a 20-year land supply for urbanizable areas, and therefore the intention is within 20 years you will be brought in and start paying those taxes for those services like parks, like roads, like police protection, or like fire, whatever the city provides.
Oh, one more follow-up. So until that happens, then there really isn't an equitable taxing structure for the for people utilizing those services.
Chair Clem, Representative Polley, no.
Thank you. I feel like I'm, you know, Perry Mason or something, but
leading the way. Any more questions for Aaron? And stick around till Mark finishes. That'd be good in case there's more things. Yeah, my silence does not mean I agree with everything you said. Like, for example, they can charge for a library card, blah, 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 but I'm not, there's no point in debating it here. I've got the gavels. I'd just be nice and call on Mr. Landauer.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 950 special districts across the state, providing, as I like to say, a panoply of different services to the citizens of Oregon. At the outset, I'd like to say that I'm glad that this discussion has sort of narrowed the focus, if you will, on what I like to term soft services. Soft services, in my definition, at least for this purpose, is for building permits, zoning, planning, of that nature. And as was mentioned previously, this is being done in a variety of communities across the state, and in particular, my most recent experience has been in the Eugene area that was explained previously. In the Eugene area, we do have a number of special districts, in particular in the Santa Clara and River Road areas, where the city has to provide building code enforcement on behalf of the county. And when individuals come to the city or are essentially forced to go to the city in order to get a building permit, the city does in fact require a consent to annexation in order to get those permits. Now, as you can imagine, this creates quite a bit of a problem for those special districts, particularly if they are a property tax-based district, because over time, if you look at these districts, there are little pockets throughout their district, and over time, their tax base diminishes. And it becomes more and more difficult over time to provide the level of service that those districts have traditionally provided in the past. And in fact, this body has dealt with this issue on a number of occasions. And in fact, in 2011, there was a bill dealing with one specific individual who wanted to divide his land in the River Road area and effectively could not do so because the city, he didn't want to consent to annexation, and the city would not issue his zoning change. So this is a fairly common issue, and we would like to continue to work with the chair of the committee to try to drive at these soft services rather than the hard services like sewer, water, roads, fire, where there's a continuation or a substantial investment in infrastructure in order to provide a service. And we hope that this can be focused in a manner that addresses the intent of the chairman as he described. Be happy to answer any questions that you may have at this point.
Questions for either of our panel? Okay. Thank you very much. That is the end of our list. Anybody else here on 2028? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2028 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2618. I try and get along. This is another one of my bills, I think. So I won't spend as much time on this one because we have people here who can talk about it. What we're trying to do when there's no live issues around this particular statute is both codify a recent court ruling and clarify when cities are able to withdraw residents from a special district and when they are not able to. So I won't spend a lot of time because you'll hear in detail some specifics in a moment. So Chris and Kevin, I got two and two again. So Chris and Kevin, do you want to come up together? And then Aaron and Mark, back on deck. One for Warren against next time. So Kevin, do you want to start or Chris, whatever you prefer?
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Chris Crane. I'm an attorney with the firm of Beery, Elsner, Hammond in Portland, where we specialize in and limit our representation exclusively to local governments. All we represent is cities, counties, special districts, and none of the above category. House Bill 2618, we came to...
And you also worked once...
I spent 6 years with legislative counsel, so I have had the... A privilege, I suppose, of both administering and litigating some of the laws I wrote, and it's certainly a double-edged sword. Nothing like facing your own mistakes 10 years down the line. So at any rate, I'll give you a quick pitch. I sent Chair Clem a copy of the judge's decision last summer in our favor, and we brought this bill to you last February, and everybody said, wait till the litigation is done and come back, so here we are. And the issue is this, that there's a deal between cities and their residents. The residents pay property taxes, and the cities deliver the services. Now, you can argue about whether people are overcharged or undercharged, but that's the basic deal. There's a bill that a statute, 221-520, that says when a city annexes territory, it can withdraw that territory from the special districts that were providing services. Makes perfect sense. If you're in a special district that provides, for example, fire service, and the city has a fire department, well, the fire department is paid for by city taxes. When a city annexes that area, it will begin providing that services in return for the payment. If you're still in the district, the fire district, paying taxes to the fire district, you're paying twice for the same service. Doesn't make any sense. So statute allows cities to withdraw territory from a special district when it annexes that territory. Well, what if the city doesn't provide the service? And apropos of the last bill, I would point out that ORS 221-760 has a list of city services that applies to cities and counties over 100,000. And every year, if those cities want their share of state shared revenue, they have to certify to the state which of those services they provide. So that may be a starting point for defining services for the other bill. At any rate, the city we were involved with annexed some territory for the purpose of from and then passed local legislation removing it from Marion County Fire, even though the city does not provide fire service. And we said, you can't do that. You can only do it if the city provides the service. And they said, where does it say that in the statute? And we're like, well, that's what it means. And we litigated it at length, and ultimately the judge agreed with us. A city is only authorized under the statute to withdraw territory from a special district if the city itself provides the service. Now, I want to make this absolutely clear. The city does not have to provide the service directly. Many, many cities provide various services by contract with counties, with special districts, with others. That's not the point. The point is, who's charging for the service? Who's collecting the money and paying for the service, either directly or by contract? If the city is doing it, it can utilize that statute and withdraw the territory from a special district. If it's not providing the service, it doesn't have authority. It can't act, as we argued in that case, as some kind of boundary commission between special districts. There are different statutes that deal with how you adjust boundaries between special districts, and overall, the special districts have to both agree. The city has no skin in the game, lacks authority to get into the process of determining special district boundaries when they don't provide the service. And that's what Judge ruled. And so we're back with the legislation that would just clarify the statute to reach that result. With that, I will defer to Chief Henson or respond to any questions you may have.
Yeah, let's have the Chief go first and then we'll do questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Henson. I'm the fire chief for Marion County Fire District Number 1. We provide fire and EMS protection to the eastern portion of Salem, unincorporated portions of Marion County, and a portion of the city of Kaiser. I want to speak in support of this bill. Approximately 18 months ago, the city of Kaiser attempted to withdraw part of our fire district from us and give it to the Kaiser Fire District. The city of Kaiser is not a full-service city, and it does not have a fire department. They have been well-served by two fire districts, Kaiser Fire District and Marion County Fire District Number 1, since the inception of the city. In our situation, we believe the city was attempting to incorrectly apply ORS 222-520. We were forced to file a lawsuit to protect our best interests. Chairman Clem attempted to help us pass a bill last session that would have promptly ended the attempted land grab, but that bill died in committee. I believe largely part of why it died in the committee was there wasn't a desire by the legislative body to get involved in a local matter. Ultimately, District Court Judge Vance Day did rule in our favor and against the city of Kaiser. Both fire districts spent more than $750,000 on this senseless legal fight. House Bill 2618 codifies his ruling. It clearly outlines that a city may only withdraw, annex, and or incorporate fire district boundaries if the city provides fire services. We are aware of many cities who have cooperative agreements with fire districts, and I believe this bill will not impact those agreements in any way. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm ready to answer any questions.
Questions for these gentlemen? Okay. Off easy.
And one item, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holdy.
Can we get a copy of that court decision?
Yes. I have it in my email, and I'll forward it to Lynn, who could distribute it to everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron and Mark, do you want to come up? And unless you two want a reverse order, Aaron, I've got you first again.
Doesn't matter. We can take turns. Chair Clem, members of the committee, again, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I've submitted written testimony and, again, will not read it to you. Our concern is we have a number of concerns with this bill. And the first and primary is the way the bill reads to cities is that this would require the city itself to provide the services. And that is not always required of us when we do withdraw service from one, when we've brought someone into our city, because we do form agreements with special districts within our city to provide services, or we may form joint agreements to provide services with other entities. And for that reason, we don't want to lose one of our tools in our toolbox to provide efficient and effective services to the folks who live within our city limits. Our concern is the way the bill is drafted will prevent us from doing that. If the decision was directed at district-on-district disagreements, the outside of city limits, those are district-to-district problems, and the city probably should not be involved. However, once it becomes a city's issue within the city, within annexed area, the local government needs to be able to determine how to best provide the services so that we don't end up with a patchwork of services provided throughout our city based on old territory boundaries. And that's the purpose of withdrawing a territory from a service once we annex them into our city limits. For those reasons, we're very concerned that this legislation goes further and prevents us from even doing that, making those decisions on behalf of our citizens who do have an elective voice and an elective representation, and when they receive urban services, expect that their city is in control of them in some way and will therefore turn to the city to find solutions. And with that, if you have any questions, please let me know.
And let's just have Mark go, then we'll do both together, if that's okay. I should have done it last time, probably. Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Mark Landauer, again, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association is supportive of this bill, House Bill 2618. At the outset, I'd like to just mention that in the case of the Kaiser situation that played out rather conspicuously here during the February session, the position of the special districts was we certainly didn't take any particular sides in the dispute between the two special districts. However, we certainly have a great deal of concern about a city being able to withdraw territory, as Mr. Crean mentioned, effectively acting as though they were a boundary commission, and then giving that withdrawn territory to another special district. There are statutes on the books that allow for special districts to merge or consolidate between themselves, and that is generally of free will in order to do that. Nevertheless, in this instance, a third party entered the dispute, if you will, and effectively made a decision for both of those separately elected bodies. Now, with that said, another point that I think is very important for this committee to understand is this dispute likely would not have occurred in the first place had an urban services agreement been in place. Under ORS 195, cities who have gone through periodic review are required to have urban services agreements. Regrettably, in this instance, the city of Kaiser did not have an urban services agreement, which would effectively have planned out how urban services, including fire, would be provided to the citizens in that area for a period of time. As a result of them not having that urban services agreement, we believe that in part this dispute came about. So we are certainly working towards ensuring that urban services agreements are followed through at this statutory requirement for cities and districts to have these urban services agreements. Nevertheless, the situation that played itself out in 2011 just north of us certainly is a pause for many districts, and we're very supportive of this measure because we don't think that if a city is not actually the service provider, they ought to be able to determine whether or shift, withdraw territory from one district and then hand it over effectively to another district. Thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions for either Aaron or Mark? Representative Holby.
Mark, you sort of laid out a scenario there. So what about the issue that if the city actually has a contract with another district to provide services, would they be able to withdraw from one district providing that service and through their contract give it to the other district that because they have a contract with that other district?
That's a very good question, and a question, frankly, Representative Holby, I had not anticipated and would really have to think through. I can certainly imagine where there may be instances where that may be the desire of a city, but again, as I said in my testimony previously, that ought to be worked out between the two districts, and there are mechanisms in the statute that would permit that to happen already. For the city to act in that manner when they aren't the actual service provider gives us a great deal of pause.
Representative Holby.
Follow up. So I'll go to Aaron now. So how does in a scenario like that, what are the costs to the city when they get caught in a situation like that of trying to provide efficient services where you're potentially end up having several different districts within your urban growth boundary providing the same service to different parts of your committee? I mean, is that a fiscal issue for cities?
Chair Clem, Representative Holby, yes, it is, because once you're within our city territories, the purpose of being in a city is to have one voice to determine how services are provided in urban areas. And if we lose that voice, we then have to determine how to provide services around a patch that might be left in another district. There are also issues of, well, you're part of the city, and say it's a fire district, and one folks' house is on fire, and you have to determine who on what side of the street do they live on, therefore who provides the services, what are so does the fire truck go out there, recognize it's on the other side of the street, and say, oh, wrong district, and let the house burn? No, the city responds. The city or the contract, the service provider that we contract with, or the city itself has to respond regardless. So there are fiscal costs as you have to patchwork around and make decisions about how infrastructure gets run. Because it's more than just fire districts, it's also infrastructure districts. If you have to work around a existing water, you might have to build your infrastructure differently in a less efficient way. And so once you're annexed or incorporated into a city, the fiscal advantage to that is having one decision maker looking at the cost outlays and determining, should we as a city provide this? Can we provide it efficiently? Can we contract with a district using an intergovernmental agreement? Shall we jointly provide with a county or any other mechanism that we find is the best cost savings to the folks who live within the city? And then we can also respond to citizens when they find that their services aren't being met at the level of expectation that they have. If they feel that, you know, there aren't enough fire stations, the city can make a decision to build another fire station with a city budget in mind.
I might ask, do you ever find among all your members a member city who doesn't want to provide the service? They also didn't, for example, really want a contract either for it. They just said, we got asked to put this on the ballot, so we're going to do it. And we're not going to do any of those things you just mentioned that your cities do. You ever find that there's one that maybe doesn't do that?
Tara Clem, I have not.
Oh, yeah, you're new to this
I'm
job.
New.
Yes.
but cities, the purposes of cities is to serve their residents. So.
Most cities do want to do that.
Representative Klein, one more.
Oh, Representative Holtby.
Just one more. I mean, Aaron, just going through that. So the idea that the cities are trying to provide these services efficiently, and this bill maybe provides a patchwork that isn't efficient, then would basically raise the taxes for people that are paying for services within that urban growth boundary as a whole.
Chair Clem, Representative Holby, it has that potential so that everybody's needs can be met at the levels they want. It might require increased taxes if there's room to increase the taxes.
So one question I think that I've got for both of you, you know, my intent certainly was to try and resolve in a way that the courts already recently have, and you know, a year ago, Legislative Council also told us was already legally resolved, in their view, a matter that cost the taxpayer $750,000 of public money to litigate, all to arrive at what had been always the common interpretation of the law. And my goal in this bill, even if it's not written that way in your view, is to try and get that resolved so we don't go through that again and don't have district-on-district warfare with cities, not, you know, cities playing host to that when they, generally speaking, didn't want to and don't want to. But we had one that tried, a few were looking at that deal. The courts clearly put the plug in that for that instance. And so do you think we can meet and get to something where we don't have cities playing boundary commission unless it's appropriate through contract or provision of services, or is it hopeless we're never going to get there? There's a philosophical disagreement over it.
Chair Clem, I would like to try and reach that point. We don't want to waste money on litigation, and in addition, it clearly the court has spoken, and therefore it's law that's out there. So even without the amendment, we might not need this legislation at all if it really is just agreeing with what the court said.
Mr. Chair, I would respond by saying, yes, I'm happy to continue the discussion. I do think that as drafted, the bill works. It codifies what the District Court of Marion County said. So if there needs to be further discussion, I'm happy to engage in those discussions. I might add, I did provide a copy of the court's ruling to your committee staff for the committee's review. And as I said, I'd be happy to continue to the discussion, but I believe that 2618 accomplishes the goal that you've set out.
Any further questions? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2618. And just for the committee's purposes, I'm intending to try and have that conversation I just described before we, you know, have any further discussion of this or action, so we can report back to you at that point if we got anywhere or not. Last one, House Bill 2617. I open a public hearing on House Bill 2617. It's another one of my bills. So I will, before I call up our folks, talk about this one. The island annexation statute is one of, I think, 13 different ways that cities can annex, and it is originally designed to pick up those pockets that actually Representative Holy was talking about a little bit and Aaron was talking about. There's pockets of people who they're surrounded by the city, and there's, you know, a house or two that's now having to be served by the sheriff, for example, or the fire district, but everything around them is served by the city fire department, and it's awkward sometimes to know what the 911 dispatcher has to figure out, are they in the city or the county, that kind of thing. So they were designed to say that within our system of annexation, sometimes there will be islands or enclaves created inadvertently, not necessarily by design, they just happen as people ask for annexation and things, and that cities may annex them even if they don't want to be annexed without their consent. We have passed legislation relatively recently that said if there's going to be an election on that, they should at least get to vote, but they don't get veto authority over whether they get annexed or not when they're in that kind of you know, freckles all over a map kind of situation. The question is, what happens if the island is enormous, city-sized? Is that what this particular statute was intended to do or not? My belief is that's not. That's the annexation plan method, or that's other methods revolving emergency annexations. If a whole area had massively polluted groundwater, the cities have the authority to already annex that whole area. So what I'm trying to do here is, when cities are having an election, which not all cities do, on island annexations, that there's some cap on the limit of island acres that can be before they need to use a different method of annexation. This is Washington's cap that you're seeing in front of us, 100 acres. I've had it as low as 20. I may have had it as high as 200. I can't remember. I've tried multiple times with this. 100 is Washington's, and the goal, again, is to say there's some limit on what we call an island when we use the island statute, and then they need to switch to other forms of annexation if they want to do an annexation of an area. And that's my pitch. Jerry, you're going to come up and say I just stole your thunder again, aren't you? But come on up anyway, and then we'll have Aaron and Mark appear together again. Maybe this time in agreement, actually. I'm not sure. No. Good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Jerry Ritter, representing Oregon Communities for Voice and Annexation. And, yeah, you told me so.
Yeah.
As we understand, the bill, its focus is fairly narrow to our 30-plus member communities that have what we call voter annexation statutes on their books. And you've explained the law. We support it for the same reason we've supported double majority in our past efforts. We think in this situation that it gives the people a voice, and our mission is to be sure that those who are most affected by annexations have a meaningful voice in the process, and we think that this bill goes a way to do that. So we do support it.
And, you know, to be honest, I don't know how to answer this, so it's dangerous to ask, but in my situation, you know, I've got two pockets that are almost, I would say almost islanded, that are, you know, between 5,000 and 6,000 people per pocket. Are there other places with those size of potential islands where there's that many people, or is that kind of a Salem-y thing?
Mr. Chairman, Lane County in the North Springfield UGB has a similar situation. And River Road, Santa Clara, as Representative Holsey mentioned, has a number of different pockets. I don't know that any of them are that large.
Okay, any questions for Jerry? Representative Holsey.
Just going back to Santa Clara, because I know you know that issue pretty well. You know, some of the areas in Santa Clara, those pockets, actually can't be built on because they can't get services to them. And so it makes it difficult if you can't provide the sewer hookup or the service because the area has too much nitrates in the ground, for example, and so they can't put any more septic tanks in that area because it's, you know, past its limit already. And so what happens with that particular area that's inside an urban growth boundary? Now we have, you know, some land that's, you know, vacant that essentially is very difficult to get a building permit on, not for reasons of, you know, who's issuing the permit, but just because you can't get the services there. And so are you aware of whether that land, maybe that's a bad question, actually that land is counted as a buildable land supply for that area? And since you can't get the, you know, because of the lack of annexation now, or the inability for those services to be provided through annexation, it can't be built on. It counts as the buildable land supply, which is putting pressure on expanding the urban growth boundary into some really valuable farmland.
It's just where Mr. Chandler and Mr. Jillians could build houses and sell them.
On valuable farmland?
No one's here from Farm Bureau, so I just thought I'd point that out.
No, I mean it's a difficult issue. I'm just pointing out that, you know, because that particular area has been plagued with this issue, mm-hmm. and it's prime farmland, and you know, it's got too many septic tanks in it, and the lack of the ability of the city to actually annex and provide those services means that it can't be built on. It's inside of an urban growth boundary and actually surrounded by residential development, and you know, it really causes urban planning difficulties and causes some conflicts with our land use laws about trying to protect that farmland, because it's, you know, some of the best farmland in the area. So you know, I don't know what the answer is. The answer is to prevent the annexation and so we can expand urban growth boundaries further into that farmland. I don't think it's really the right solution.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, I'm aware of the situation out there, and there are a number of different situations, and they are problematic, as you've noted. If there is a groundwater problem, and if the area is contiguous, it can be annexed under 222-850. That's one option. But we have a number of different patches out there. You have in-city groups and out-of-city groups, and it's quite a patchwork, and it is an issue. I don't know that any of them are large enough to be impacted by this particular bill, but I recognize the problem. We're aware of it.
I think, Jerry, just, you know, I think I finally found a consensus point with my city over annexation. I'd be interested in your take. I think we both agree that in areas that have already been urbanized to urban levels of services, this isn't about a land use planning issue in terms of that. It's more about the taxation from their perspective and is it being fairly appropriated. But from a planning level, they already are built to neighborhood densities and all that kind of stuff. If they're not, from an infrastructure standpoint, they can use emergency, health and safety annexations to get them. But it seems to be, at least in certain parts of Oregon, about taxation equity more than land use planning. If it's bare ground, it seems to be, like Representative Holvey's talking about, but more about land use planning and infrastructure and buildable supply. Is that sort of where you see, I know for you there's voter input as well, but is that sort of where you see this shaking out?
Mr. Chairman,
are you anti-land use planning, I guess, is the question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem really goes back because Oregon annexation law, much of it was written prior to Senate Bill 100, and so we find that annexation statutes and land use statutes are sometimes in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
And we've tried to resolve some of those through legislation. I'm in the same situation. I live outside the Springfield city limits in the urban growth boundary, area that's already developed to urban standards. And in fact, we're in discussions with the city right now on ways to talk people into annexing voluntarily if they so want. So I don't have the answers that you're looking for on that, but our main mission is to be sure that if you're going to be annexed and your costs are going to go way up, we want you to have a meaningful voice in that process. And we feel that this bill is a step toward that.
Any more questions for Jerry? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron and Mark. This time Mark's going to have to go first, just because I'm sure this has been unfair so far. You signed up last, but sorry.
That's okay. Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Again, I'm Mark Landauer, representing the Special Districts Association. Since our inception, the Special Districts Association has strongly held that the right of people to choose through a vote how they get their services and by whom they are governed is a principle that we've held onto very strongly. That is why we support annexation methods that allow for voters to choose whether or not they should be annexed to a city. With that said, we are concerned about this bill. We are supportive of the fact that in the bill, the measure allows for the votes in the city and the territory being proposed for annexation would permit a separate counting of those votes. However, we are very concerned about the limitation or the size by which that measure would be applied. We feel that 100 acres is entirely too big, and an example might be, this is where you have the disagreement, right, that in an area that has 99 acres may have simply one person, whereas a territory that has 101 acres may have one person as well. But in those instances where you have a very large population base, those individuals' votes we believe, ought to be counted separately. So perhaps having an acreage standard isn't necessarily the best approach in this instance. And that is essentially the summation of my testimony. We really hold on to the belief that if people want to be annexed, they're more apt to be supportive of the city's efforts to issue bonds at some future date. They won't be suspect of their new government that they now belong to. They ought to have a voice. And that's really the summation of my testimony. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Aaron, do you want to go ahead?
Again, Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon City. I won't go over my written testimony, but I will address a couple of things. We are, of course, very concerned about the 100 acres with one property owner, particularly if that property owner isn't allowed to vote under the law. If it's a corporation that owns it with a plan to develop it but hasn't yet, they don't really get a vote, and therefore you can't reach a majority of zero, is one flaw that we have. Another issue that goes back to a conversation we had earlier about folks who live, if it is a highly urbanized area, those folks are getting city services. They're driving into, especially if they are truly an island surrounded by a city, it may not be everything, but you're driving on the roads, you're using the parks, you have access to all of those things that city residents have paid for through their tax base, and therefore, if we're going to have that vote, if the city charter or requirements of the city are to have a vote, it needs to, all those affected should have a vote that is counted as one, instead of allowing a veto of an area that wants to continue at whatever tax base they're at, but still receive the benefit of living literally within a city without paying like a citizen of the city. And, you know, 100 acres may be the size of a city in some areas, but not others. It can, it depends upon where you live, how big 100 acres really is. So I think that our concern is that by fiddling with the already much fraught annexation laws, by changing the voting structure, you're really still putting the burden on those who are within the cities to help cover the cost of those who are surrounded by the city. And I'll take be happy to answer any questions.
So before Reverend Holy starts, I'll just, we talked a little bit about this beforehand, but wouldn't in this situation where a company owns a islanded tract of, say, 101 acres, wouldn't they be able to use the way Pixweet's company, and the company that owns the Pixweet Corporation in Salem used a triple majority annexation just recently to get annexed, instead of using the island method, because that's an owner-initiated, owner-consented, and if they're the only elector and they own the property, it says that if they own the majority of the people, the majority of the property, and the majority of the taxes paid or something like that, they are a voter in and of themselves, and you don't have to have an election under that statute, or there would be a role for the corporation to have a voice in that.
Chair Clem, I think I'm... The issue is if the mandate in the city charter requires a vote on any and all annexations into property, that can happen. I don't have numbers of charters that read that way, but there are a number of charters that do require voting for any annexation, like King City, Newburgh, Salem, and there might be workarounds that the cities have set up for themselves, but I don't know that this is the fix.
So, sorry, I might have been a little unclear. Salem did have an election as well.
Right.
The annexation was initiated by the corporation, then the voters voted on it in a single majority status. And if I'm understanding what you're worried about, if that election had been double majority, there was no one to count one way or the other on the other side.
Jericho, that's correct.
So here's where I think you're wrong. That was not an island annexation. This bill only applies to annexation. That was a triple majority annexation, and the provision of this bill would not apply to that situation.
Uh-huh. Chair Clem, I understand, but I do think that, it can occur within an island as well. It's not just people who are contiguous to the city. I think it's possible, and if I can foresee it, it handicaps the ability to deal with those areas where this might arise. And if we're going to, you know, just limit it to islands, you still have to account for the possibility of accidentally creating an island around a corporation in particular areas.
Yeah, you're right. For example, Beaverton tried to create an island around a corporation, and they would not have had the ability to vote under the island deal. I don't think Beaverton has voter approval, though, in that case. But if they did, they would not be able to. But it was done under the island statute. Mm-hmm. So we would have to create, to make you happy, we'd have to create some mechanism and make your organization happy. We'd have to create some mechanism for that entity to get to weigh in, since they're not registered to vote, because they're a corporation, and corporations are either people or not, depending on who you ask.
Chair Lum, I also would point out that we are still concerned just generally about changing the voting structure on the basis of the fact that these folks, even in areas that aren't one owner, they are getting the benefit of living within a city without paying the taxation for it. And if you allow them to veto through a majority vote, that prevents good urban planning and will cause sprawl in ways that are unintended. So if we can instead use the annexation rules that are currently on the books to make sure that urban areas remain within those urban boundaries easily instead of spreading out and creating more urban sprawl, that is the preferred method under the land use statutes that are already on the book. And as was pointed out, I believe, by the governor's office, Washington is not as efficient as we are, and we like that efficiency under our land use, and so adopting their standards might not be the best.
Before I go to Representative Foley, my last point, they literally don't live within a city. That's why they're subject to annexation. They live in the county, not the city. Thank you. Isn't that right? No, just kidding. Representative Foley.
Thank you, Chair. I think the only point I wanted to make is I think my concern with the double majority status is essentially that you can have an island that's, you know, essentially able to have all the urban services, mm-hmm. and yet with that double majority having, they could just elect not to go into the city and still get all those services and not really pay the same that everybody else is paying for them. Mm-hmm. So it's that inequity in that scenario of a double majority that creates a situation where, you know, if I lived in that unincorporated area that was surrounded by the city, and I could vote to not go into the city and pay their taxes and yet still have all the services, you know, I think they would generally vote that way because it's cheaper for them, and, you know, that financial interest isn't equitable to the rest of the citizens that are inside the city. So our philosophical argument again.
Fair enough. Any other members besides Representative Holvey? And I want to say a single... Oh, no, Representative Davis, you said a few things earlier. Thank you. Any further questions?
If you keep going, this could be a two-person committee.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I think everyone is about to leave.
I did try to come late.
Any further questions for these nice people? All right. With that, thank you. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2617. And then we've got two legislative concepts I'd like to ask your indulgence to introduce. I can describe them briefly. They just came in right before the committee. One involves, OFIC is not here to talk about it. Let me just talk about it. One involves an issue for large forest land holders where they've purchased a large piece of property, and there's a home on it. And they're interested in continuing their ongoing forestry operations, and they don't want to use that home for anything. So their goal is to have the ability to restrict to the bare minimum the size of that lot for that one existing home, so they can sell it and leave the bulk of their forest land intact versus whatever the minimum acreage might be that then would have to go with the home. And so they'd like to keep the ownership in their hands
for forestry-related activities and forestry-related zoning to the greatest extent they can. So that's that bill. Again, no pledge of support by allowing the bill to be introduced, but that's the bill. And then the other one. The other one is. The other one is related to what we just talked about, LC 3131. That would require that local governments, including special districts, enter into urban service agreements not later than January 1, 2015. So this would be to try and promote urban service agreement so we don't end up with as many issues as we have. So those are the two LCs. With your indulgence, I'd like to introduce them, not committing you to any support or opposition to these two, but just like to get them in as committee bills before the.
Mr. Chair, I'll move LC 3131, dated 2/19/15, and LC.
They're separate.
They're separate, okay.
No, just do them together. And LC 3367, dated 12, this one says 12/19/13. Should it be 2/19/13?
Yes.
To be introduced as committee bills, I'll move that.
Vice Chair Cameron moves the LCs 3131 and 3367 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the bills will be introduced. And I'm trying to. I'm going to carry over House Bill 2617 and the others we'll just reschedule once we've had some meetings about them when I think we're even possibly close to any kind of language. And with that, thank you for tolerating Annexation Day here at the Capitol.
That implies a singular day.
I was trying to, but I think Representative Greenwick has an issue that I don't want to call annexation. But
yesterday was I-5 day.
Yeah, right. Thank you for your patience and attendance with my three bills. And with that, the committee is adjourned.